He understood their quarks and squawks. They are his eyes and ears. They scout for him and whisper to him of dangers ahead and behind. As now, the elk stopped suddenly, and the ranger bolted lightly from his back to land in knee-deep snow. Summer growled at him, his fur bristling. The direwolf did not like the way that Cold Hand smelled.
Dead meat, dried blood, a faint whiff of rot, and cold, cold over all.
What is it?
Mira wanted to know. Behind us, Cold Hands announced, his voice muffled by the black wool scarf across his nose and mouth.
Wolves, Bran asked.
They had known for days that they were being followed. Every night they heard the mournful howling of the pack, and every night the wolves seemed a little closer.
Hunters and hungry, they can smell how weak we are.
Often Bran woke shivering hours before the dawn, listening to the sound of them calling to one another in the distance as he waited for the sun to rise.
If there are wolves, there must be prey,
he used to think, until it came to him that they were the prey. The ranger shook his head.
Men, the wolves still keep their distance. These men are not so shy.
Mira Reed pushed back her hood. The wet snow that had covered it tumbled to the ground with a soft thump.
How many men? Who are they?
Foes. I'll deal with them.
I'll come with you.
You'll stay. The boy must be protected. There's a lake ahead, hard frozen. When you come on it, turn north and follow the shoreline. You'll come to a fishing village. Take refuge there until I can catch up with you.
Bran thought that Mira meant to argue, until her brother said,
Do as he says. He knows this land.
Jojen's eyes were a dark green, the color of moss, but heavy with a weariness that Bran had never seen in them before.
The little grandfather.
South of the wall, the boy from the Crannogs had seemed to be wise beyond his years, but up here he was as lost and frightened as the rest of them. Even so, Mira always listened to him. That was still true. Cold Hands slipped between the trees back the way they'd come, with four ravens flapping after him. Mira watched him go, her cheeks red with cold, breath puffing from her nostrils. She pulled her hood back and gave the elk a nudge, and their trek resumed. Before they had gone 20 yards, though, she turned to glance behind them and said,
Men, he says. What men? Does he mean wildlings? Why won't he say?
He said he'd go and deal with them, said Bran.
He said, aye. He said he would take us to the Three-Eyed Crow, too. That river we crossed this morning is the same one we crossed 4 days ago, I swear. We're going in circles. Rivers turn and twist,
Bran said uncertainly,
and where there's lakes and hills, you need to go around.
There's been too much going around,
Mira insisted,
and too many secrets. I don't like it. I don't like him, and I don't trust him. Those hands of his are bad enough. He hides his face and will not speak a name. Who is he? What is he? Anyone can put on a black cloak, anyone, or anything. He does not eat, he never drinks. He does not seem to feel the cold.
It's true. Bran had been afraid to speak of it, but he had noticed. Whenever they took shelter for the night, while he and Hodor and the Reeds huddled together for warmth, the ranger kept apart. Sometimes Cold Hands closed his eyes, but Bran did not think he slept. And there was something else.
The scarf!
Bran glanced about uneasily, but there was not a raven to be seen. All the big black birds had left them when the ranger did. No one was listening. Even so, he kept his voice low.
The scarf over his mouth. It never gets all hard with ice, like Hordar's beard. Not even when he talks.
Mira gave him a sharp look.
You're right. We've never seen his breath, have we?
No.
A puff of white heralded each of Hodor's Hodors. When Jojen or his sister spoke, their words could be seen too, Even the elk left a warm fog upon the air when he exhaled.
If he does not breathe...
Bran found himself remembering the tales old Nan had told him when he was a babe.
Beyond the wall, the monsters live. The giants and the ghouls, the stalking shadows and the dead that walk,
she would say, tucking him in beneath his scratchy woolen blanket.
But they cannot pass so long as the wall stands strong, and the men of the Night's Watch are true. So go to sleep, my little Brendan, my baby boy, and dream sweet dreams. There are no monsters here.
The ranger wore the black of the Night's Watch. But what if he was not a man at all? What if he was some monster, taking them to the other monsters to be devoured?
The ranger saved Sam and the girl from the whites,
Bran said hesitantly.
And he's taken me to the three-eyed crow. Why won't this three-eyed crow come to us? Why couldn't he meet us at the wall? Crows have wings. My brother grows weaker every day. How long can we go on?
Jojen coughed.
Until we get there.
They came upon the promised lake not long after, and turned north as the ranger had bid them. That was the easy part. The water was frozen, and the snow had been falling for so long that Bran had lost count of the days, turning the lake into a vast white wilderness. Where the ice was flat and the ground was bumpy, the going was easy. But where the wind had pushed the snow up into ridges, sometimes it was hard to tell where the lake ended and the shore began. Even the trees were not as infallible a guide as they might have hoped, for there were wooded islands in the lake and wide areas ashore where no trees grew. The elk went where he would, regardless of the wishes of Mira and Jojen on his back. Mostly he stayed beneath the trees, but where the shore curved away westward, he would take the more direct path across the frozen lake, shouldering through snowdrifts taller than Bran as the ice crackled underneath his hooves. Out there, the wind was stronger, a cold north wind that howled across the lake, knifed through their layers of wool and leather, and set them all to shivering. When it blew into their faces, it would drive the snow into their eyes and leave them good as blind. Hours passed in silence. Ahead, shadows began to steal between the trees, the long fingers of the dusk. Dark came early this far north. Bran had come to dread that. Each day seemed shorter than the last, and where the days were cold, the nights were bitter cruel. Mira halted them again.
"We should have come on the village by now."
Her voice sounded hushed and strange.
"Could we have passed it?"
Bran asked.
"I hope not. We need to find shelter before nightfall."
She was not wrong. Jojen's lips were blue, Mira's cheeks dark red. Bran's own face had gone numb. Hodor's beard was solid ice. Snow caked his legs almost to the knee, and Bran had felt him stagger more than once. No one was as strong as Hodor, no one. If even his great strength was failing.
"Summer can find the village," Bran said suddenly,
his words misting in the air. He did not wait to hear what Mira might say, but closed his eyes and let himself flow from his broken body. As he slipped inside a summer skin, the dead woods came to sudden life. Where before there had been silence, now he heard wind in the trees, Hodor's breathing, the elk pawing at the ground in search of fodder. Familiar scents filled his nostrils, wet leaves and dead grass, the rotted carcass of a squirrel decaying in the brush, the sour stink of man's sweat, the musky odor of the elk.
"Food! Meat!"
The elk sensed his interest. He turned his head toward the direwolf, weary, and lowered his great antlers.
"He is not prey," the boy whispered to the beast who shared his skin. "Leave him! Run!"
Summer ran. Across the lake he raced. his paws kicking up sprays of snow behind him. The trees stood shoulder to shoulder like men in a battle line, all cloaked in white. Over roots and rocks the direwolf sped. Through a drift of old snow, the cross crackling beneath his weight, his paws grew wet and cold. The next hill was covered with pines, and the sharp scent of their needles filled the air. When he reached the top, he turned in a circle, sniffing at the air, then raised his head and howled. The smells were there, man-smells.
Ashes, Bran thought. Old and faint, but ashes.
It was a smell of burnt wood, soot and charcoal, a dead fire. He shook the snow off his muzzle. The wind was gusting, so the smells were hard to follow. The wolf turned this way and that, sniffing. All around were heaps of snow and tall trees garbed in white. The wolf let his tongue loll out between his teeth, tasting the frigid air, his breath misting as snowflakes melted on his tongue. When he trotted towards the scent, Hodor lumbered after him at once. The elk took longer to decide, so Bran returned reluctantly to his own body and said,
"That way, follow summer. I smelled it."
As the first sliver of a crescent moon came peeking through the clouds, they finally stumbled into the village by the lake. They'd almost walked straight through it. From the ice, the village looked no different than a dozen other spots along the lake shore. Buried under drifts of snow, the round stone houses could just as easily have been boulders or hillocks or fallen logs, like the deadfall that Jojen had mistaken for a building the day before, until they dug down into it and found only broken branches and rotting logs. The village was empty, abandoned by the wildlings who had once lived there, like all the other villages they had passed. Some had been burned, as if the inhabitants had wanted to make certain they could not come creeping back, but this one had been spared the torch. Beneath the snow they found a dozen huts and a long hall, with its sud roof and thick walls of rough-hewn logs.
"At least we will be out of the wind," Bran said.
"Hodor," said Hodor.
Mira slid down from the elk's back. She and her brother helped lift Bran out of the wicker basket.
"Might be the wildlings left some food behind," she said.
That proved a forlorn hope. Inside the long hall, they found the ashes of a fire, floors of hard-packed dirt, a chill that went bone-deep. But at least they had a roof above their heads and log walls to keep the wind off. A stream ran nearby, covered with a film of ice. The elk had to crack it with his hoof to drink. Once Bran and Jojen and Hodor were safely settled, Mira fetched back some chunks of broken ice for them to suck on. The melting water was so cold it made Bran shudder. Summer did not follow them into the long hall. Bran could feel the big wolf's hunger, a shadow of his own.
"Go, aunt," he told him, "but you leave the elk alone."
Part of him was wishing he could go hunting too. Perhaps he would, later. Supper was a fistful of acorns, crushed and pounded into paste, so bitter that Bran gagged as he tried to keep it down. Jojen Reed did not even make the attempt. Younger and frailer than her sister, he was growing weaker by the day.
"Jojen, you have to eat," Mira told him. "Later, I just want to rest."
Jojen smiled a wan smile.
"This is not the day I die, sister, I promise you." "You almost fell off the elk." "Almost. I am cold and hungry, that's all."
"Then eat."
"Crushed acorns. My belly hurts, but that will only make it worse. Leave me be, sister. I'm dreaming of roast chicken."
"Dreams will not sustain you, not even green dreams."
"Dreams are what we have."
All we have. The last of the food that they had brought from the south was 10 days gone. Since then, hunger walked beside them day and night. Even summer could find no game in these woods. They lived on crushed acorns and raw fish. The woods were full of frozen streams and cold black lakes, and Mira was as good a fisher with her three-pronged frog spear as most men were with hook and line. Some days her lips were blue with cold by the time she waded back to them, with her catch wriggling on her tines. It had been 3 days since Mira caught a fish, however. Bran's belly felt so hollow, it might have been 3 years. After they choked down their meager supper, Mira sat with her back against the wall, sharpening her dagger on a whetstone. Hodor squatted down beside the door, rocking back and forth on his haunches and muttering, "Hodor, Hodor, Hodor." Bran closed his eyes. It was too cold to talk, and they dare not light a fire. Cold Hands had warned them against that. "These woods are not as empty as you think," he had said. "You cannot know what the light might summon from the darkness." The memory made him shiver, despite the warmth of Hodor beside him. Sleep would not come, could not come. Instead, there was wind, the biting cold, moonlight on snow, and fire. He was back inside summer, long leagues away, and the night was rank with the smell of blood. The scent was strong. A kill, not far. The flesh would still be warm. Slaver ran between his teeth as the hunger woke inside him. Not elk, not deer, not this. The direwolf moved toward the meat, a gaunt gray shadow sliding from tree to tree, through pools of moonlight and over mounds of snow. The wind gusted around him, shifting. He lost the scent, found it, then lost it again. As he searched for it once more, a distant sound made his ears prick up. Wolf! He knew at once. Summer stalked toward the sound, wary now. Soon enough the scent of blood was back. But now there were other smells. Piss and dead skins, bird shit, feathers, and wolf, 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 a pack. He would need to fight for his meat. They smelled him too, as he moved out from amongst the darkness of the trees into the bloody glade. They were watching him. The female was chewing on a leather boot that still had half a leg in it, but she let it fall at his approach. The leader of the pack, an old male with a grizzled white muzzle and a blind eye, moved out to meet him, snarling, his teeth bared. Behind him, a younger male showed his fangs as well. The direwolf's pale yellow eyes drank in the sights around them. A nest of entrails coiled through a bush, entangled with the branches, steam rising from an open belly, rich with the smells of blood and meat. A head staring sightlessly up at a horned moon, cheeks ripped and torn down to bloody bone, pits for eyes, neck ending in a ragged stump, a pool of frozen blood, glistening red and black. Men! The stink of them filled the world. Alive they had been as many as the fingers on a man's paw, but now they were none.
Dead! Done! Meat!
Cloaked and hooded once, but the wolves had torn their clothing into pieces in their frenzy to get at the flesh. Those who still had faces wore thick beards crusted with ice and frozen snot. The falling snow had begun to bury what remained of them, so pale against the black of ragged cloaks and breeches. Black! Long leagues away, the boy stirred uneasily. Black! Night's watch! They were night's watch! The direwolf did not care. They were meat. He was hungry. The eyes of the three wolves glowed yellow. The direwolf swung his head from side to side, nostrils flaring, then bared his fangs in a snarl. The younger male backed away. The direwolf could smell the fear in him. Tail, he knew. But the one-eyed wolf answered with a growl and moved to block his advance.
Head, and he does not fear me.
though I'm twice his size. Their eyes met. Warg! Then the two rushed together, wolf and direwolf, and there was no more time for thought. The world shrunk down to tooth and claw, snow flying as they rolled and spun and tore at one another, the other wolf snarling and snapping around them. His jaws closed on matted fur, slick with hoarfrost, on a limb thin as a dry stick, but the one-eyed wolf clawed at his belly and tore himself free, rolled, lunged for him. Yellow Fang snapped closed on his throat, but he shook off his old grey cousin as he would a rat, then charged after him, knocked him down, rolling, ripping, kicking. They fought until the both of them were ragged and fresh blood dappled the snows around them. But finally the old one-eyed wolf lay down and showed his belly. The dire wolf snapped at him twice more, sniffed at his butt, then lifted a leg over him. A few snaps and a warning growl, and the female on the tail submitted too. The pack was his. The prey as well. He went from man to man, sniffing before settling on the biggest, a faceless thing who clutched black iron in one hand. His other hand was missing, severed at the wrist, his stump bound up in leather. Blood flowed thick and sluggish from the slash across his throat. The wolf lapped at it with his tongue, licked the ragged, eyeless ruin of his nose and cheeks, then buried his muzzle in his neck and tore it open, gulping down a gobbet of sweet meat. No flesh had ever tasted half as good. When he was done with that one, he moved to the next, and devoured the choicest bits of that man, too. Ravens watched him from the trees, squatting dark-eyed and silent on the branches as snow drifted down around them. The other wolves made do with his leavings. The old male fed first, then the female, then the tail. They were his now. They were pack.
No, the boy whispered. We have another pack. Lady's dead, and maybe Grey Wind too. But somewhere there's still Shaggy Dog and Nymeria and Ghost. Remember Ghost?
Falling snow and feasting wolves began to dim. Warmth beat against his face, comforting as a mother's kisses. Fire, he thought. Smoke. His nose twitched to the smell of roasting meat. And then the forest fell away, and he was back in the long hall again, back in his broken body, staring at a fire. Mira Reed was turning a chunk of raw, red flesh above the flames, letting it char and spit.
Just in time, she said.
Bran rubbed his eyes with the heel of his hand and wriggled backwards against the wall to sit.
You almost slept through supper. The ranger found a sow.
Behind her, Hodor was tearing eagerly at a chunk of hot, charred flesh as blood and grease ran down into his beard. Wisps of smoke rose from between his fingers.
Hodor, he muttered between bites. Hodor! Hodor!
His sword lay on the earthen floor beside him. Jojen Reed nipped at his own joint with small bites, chewing each chunk of meat a dozen times before swallowing.
The ranger killed a pig.
Cold Hand stood beside the door, a raven on his arm, both staring at the fire. Reflections from the flames glittered off four black eyes.
He does not eat, Bran remembered, and he fears the flames. You said no fire,
he reminded the ranger.
The walls around us hide the light, and dawn is close. We will be on our way soon.
What happened to the men, the foes behind us?
They will not trouble you.
Who were they, wildlings?
Mira turned the meat to cook the other side. Hodor was chewing and swallowing, muttering happily under his breath. Only Jojen seemed aware of what was happening as Cold Hands turned his head to stare at Bran.
They were foes.
Men of the Night's Watch, you killed them. You and the ravens, their faces were all torn, and their eyes were gone.
Cold Hands did not deny it.
They were your brothers. I saw. The wolves had ripped their clothes up, but I could still tell. Their cloaks were black, like your hands.
Cold Hand said nothing.
Who are you? Why are your hands black?
The ranger studied his hands as if he'd never noticed them before. Once the heart has ceased to beat, a man's blood runs down into his extremities, where it thickens and congeals. His voice rattled in his throat, as thin and gaunt as he was. His hands and feet swell up and turn as black as pudding. The rest of him becomes as white as milk. Mira Reed rose, her frog spear in her hand, a chunk of smoking meat still impaled upon its tines.
"Show us your face."
The ranger made no move to obey.
"He's dead."
Bran could taste the bile in his throat.
"Mira, he's some dead thing. The monsters cannot pass so long as the wall stands and the men of the Night's Watch stay true. That's what old Nan used to say. He came to meet us at the wall, but he could not pass. He sent Sam instead, with that wildling girl."
Mira's gloved hand tightened around the shaft of her frog spear.
"Who sent you? Who is this three-eyed crow?"
"A friend, dreamer, wizard. Call him what you will. The last green seer." The long hall's wooden door banged open. Outside, the night wind howled, bleak and black. The trees were full of ravens screaming. Cold Hands did not move.
"A monster," Bran said.
The ranger looked at Bran as if the rest of them did not exist.
"Your monster, Brandon Stark."
"Yours," the raven echoed from his shoulder. Outside the door, the ravens in the trees took up the cry until the night wood echoed to the murderous song of, "Yours, yours, yours."
"Jojen, did you dream this?"
Mira asked her brother.
"Who is he? What is he? What do we do now?"
"We go with a ranger," said Jojen. "We have come too far to turn back now, Mira. We would never make it back to the wall alive. We go with Bran's monster, or we die."
Tyrion. They departed Pentos by the Sunrise Gate, though Tyrion Lannister never glimpsed the sunrise.
"It will be as if you had never come to Pentos, my little friend," promised Magister Illyrio, as he drew shut the litter's purple velvet drapes. "No man must see you leave the city, as no man saw you enter."
"No man except the sailors who stuffed me in that barrel, the cabin boy who cleaned up after me, the girl you sent to warm my bed, and that treacherous, freckled washerwoman. Oh, and your guards, unless you remove their wits along with their balls. They know you're not alone in here." The litter was suspended between eight mammoth draft horses on heavy leather straps. Four eunuchs paced beside the horses, two to either side, and more were trudging along behind to guard the baggage train.
"Unsolid tell no tales," Illyrio assured him. "And the galley that delivered you is on her way to Ashai even now. It will be 2 years before she returns, if the seas are kind. As for my household, they love me well. None would betray me."
"Cherish that thought, my fat friend. One day we will carve those words upon your crypt."
"We should be aboard that galley," the dwarf said. "The fastest way to Valentis is by sea."
"The sea is hazardous," replied Illyrio. "Autumn is a season rife with storms, and pirates still make their dens upon the stepstones and venture forth to prey on honest men. It would never do for my little friend to fall into such hands."
"There are pirates on the Rhône as well."
River pirates, the cheesemonger gave a yawn, covering his mouth with the back of his hand. Cockroach captains scurrying after crumbs. One hears talk of stone men as well. Oh, they are real enough, poor damn things. But why speak of such things? The day is too fine for such talk. We shall see the Rhoyne soon, and there you shall be rid of Illyrio and his big belly. Till then, let us drink and dream. We have sweet wine and savouries to enjoy. Why dwell upon disease and death?
Why indeed? Tyrion heard the thrum of a crossbow once again, and wondered. The litter swayed side to side, a soothing movement that made him feel as if he were a child being rocked to sleep in his mother's arms. Not that they would know what that was like. Silk pillows, stuffed with goose down, cushioned his cheeks. The purple velvet walls curved overhead to form a roof, making it pleasantly warm within, despite the autumn chill outside. A train of mules trailed behind them, carrying chests and casks and barrels, and hampers of delectables to keep the Lord of Cheese from growing peckish. They nibbled on spiced sausage that morning, washed down with a dark smokeberry brown. Jellied eels and Dornish reds filled their afternoon. Come evening, there were sliced hams, boiled eggs, and roasted larks stuffed with garlic and onions, with pale ales and Mearish fire wines to help in their digestion. The litter was as slow as it was comfortable, however, and the dwarf soon found himself itching with impatience.
"How many days until we reach the river?" he asked Illyrio that evening. "At this pace your queen's dragons will be larger than Aegon III before I can lay eyes upon them."
"Would it were so. A large dragon is more fearsome than a small one," the magister shrugged. "Much as it would please me to welcome Queen Daenerys to Volantis, I must rely on you and Griff for that. I can serve her best in Pentos, smoothing the way for her return. So long as I'm with you, though, well, an old fat man must have his comforts, yes? Come, drink a cup of wine."
"Tell me," Tyrion said as he drank, "why should a magister of Pentos give 3 figs who wears the crown in Westeros? Where is the gain for you in this venture, my lord?"
The fat man dabbed grease from his lips. "I am an old man, grown weary of this world and its treacheries. Is it so strange that I should wish to do some good before my days are done, to help a sweet young girl regain her birthright?"
"Next you will be offering me a suit of magic armor and a palace in Valyria." "If Daenerys is no more than a sweet young girl, the Iron Throne will cut her into sweet young pieces."
"Fear not, my little friend. The blood of Aegon the Dragon flows in her veins."
"Along with the blood of Aegon the Unworthy, Maegor the Cruel, and Baelor the Befuddled."
"Tell me more of her."
The fat man grew pensive.
"Daenerys was half a child when she came to me, yet fairer even than my second wife. So lovely, I was tempted to claim her for myself. Such a fearful, furtive thing, however, I knew I should get no joy from coupling with her. Instead, I summoned a bedwarmer and fucked her vigorously until the madness passed. If truth be told, I did not think Daenerys would survive for long amongst the horse lords."
"That did not stop you selling her to Khal Drogo?"
"Dothraki neither buy nor sell. Say rather that her brother Viserys gave her to Drogo to win the Khal's friendship. A vain young man and greedy. Viserys lusted for his father's throne, but he lusted for Daenerys too, and was loath to give her up.
the night before the princess wed, he tried to steal into her bed, insisting that if he could not have her hand, he would claim her maidenhead. Had I not taken the precaution of posting guards upon her door, the series might have undone years of planning.
He sounds an utter fool.
Viserys was Mad Aerys' son, just so. Daenerys is quite different.
He popped a roasted lark into his mouth and crunched it noisily, bones and all.
The frightened child who sheltered in my manse died on the Dothraki Sea and was reborn in blood and fire. This dragon queen who wears her name is a true Targaryen. When I sent ships to bring her home, she turned towards Slaver's Bay. In a short span of days, she conquered Astapor, made Yunkai bend the knee, and sacked Meereen. Mentares will be next, if she marches west along the Ovalerian roads. If she comes by sea, well, her fleet must take on food and water at Volantis. By land or by sea, there are long leagues between Meereen and Volantis, Tyrion observed. 550, as the dragon flies, through deserts, mountains, swamps, and demon-haunted ruins. Many and more will perish, but those who survive will be stronger by the time they reach Volantis, where they shall find you and Griff awaiting them, with fresh forces and sufficient ships to carry them all across the sea to Westeros. Tyrion pondered all he knew of Volantis, oldest and proudest of the 9 free cities. Something was awry here. Even with half a nose, he could smell it.
It said there are 5 slaves for every free man in Volantis. Why would the Triarchs assist a queen who smashed the slave trade? He pointed at Illyria. For that matter, why would you? Slavery may be forbidden by the laws of Pentos, yet you have a finger in that trade as well, and maybe a whole hand. And yet you conspire for the Dragon Queen and not against her. Why? What do you hope to gain from Queen Daenerys?
Oh, are we back to that again? You are a persistent little man. Illyrio gave a laugh and slapped his belly. As you will. The beggar king swore that I should be his master of coin, and a lordly lord as well. Once he wore his golden crown, I should have my choice of castles, even Casterly Rock, if I desired.
Tyrion snorted wine back up the scarred stump that had been his nose. My father would have loved to hear that.
Your lord father had no cause for concern. Why would I want a rock, eh? My manse is large enough for any man, and more comfortable than your draughty Westerosi castles. Master of coin, though. The fat man peeled another egg. I am fond of coins. Is there any sound as sweet as the clink of gold on gold? A sister screams. Are you quite certain that Daenerys will make good her brother's promises? Oh, she will, or she will not. Illyrio bit the egg in half. I told you, my little friend, not all that a man does is done for gain. Believe as you wish, but even fat old fools like me have friends and debts of affection to repay.
Liar, thought Tyrion, there is something in this venture worth more to you than coin or castles.
You meet so few men who value friendship over gold these days.
Too true, the fat man said, deaf to the irony.
How is it that the spider became so dear to you? We were young together, 2 green boys in Pentos.
Varys came from Myr.
Yes, so he did. I met him not long after he arrived, one step ahead of the slavers. By day he slept in the sewers, by night he prowled the rooftops like a cat. I was near as poor, a bravo in soiled silks, living by my blade. Perhaps you chanced to glimpse the statue by my pool. Pytho Melanon carved that when I was 6 and 10. A lovely thing, though now I weep to see it. Age makes ruins of us all. I am still in mourning for my nose. But Varys, in Mir he was a prince of thieves, until a rival thief informed on him. In Pentos his accent marked him, and once he was known for a eunuch, he was despised and beaten. Why he chose me to protect him I may never know, but we came to an arrangement. Varys spied on lesser thieves and took their takings. I offered my help to their victims, promising to recover their valuables for a fee. Soon every man who had suffered a loss knew to come to me, while cities, footpads, and cutpurses sought out Varys, half to slit his throat, the other half to sell him what they had stolen. We both grew rich, and richer still when Varys trained his mice.
In King's Landing he kept little birds.
Mice, we called them then. The older thieves were fools who thought no further than turning a knight's plunder into wine. Varys preferred orphan boys and young girls. He chose the smallest, the ones who were quick and quiet, and taught them to climb walls and slip down chimneys. He taught them to read as well. We left the gold and gems for common thieves. Instead, our mice stole letters, ledgers, charts. Later they would read them and leave them where they lay. Secrets are worth more than silver or sapphires, Varys claimed. Just so, I grew so respectable that a cousin of the Prince of Pentos let me wed his maiden daughter, whilst whispers of a certain eunuch's talents crossed the narrow sea and reached the ears of a certain king, a very anxious king, who did not wholly trust his son, nor his wife, nor his hand, a friend of his youth who had grown arrogant and overproud. I do believe that you know the rest of this tale. Is that not so?
Much of it, Tyrion admitted. I see that you are somewhat more than a cheesemonger, after all.
Illyrio inclined his head. You are kind to say so, my little friend, and for my part, I see that you are just as quick as Lord Varys claimed. He smiled, showing all his crooked yellow teeth, and shouted for another jar of Moorish fire wine. When the magister drifted off to sleep with a wine jar at his elbow, Tyrion crept across the pillows to work it loose from its fleshy prison and pour himself a cup. He drained it down and yawned, and filled it once again. "If I drink enough fire wine," he told himself, "perhaps I'll dream of dragons." When he was still a lonely child in the depths of Casterly Rock, he off-rode dragons through the nights, pretending he was some lost Targaryen princeling, or a Valyrian dragon lord soaring high o'er fields and mountains. Once, when his uncles asked him what gift he wanted for his name day, he begged them for a dragon. "It wouldn't need to be a big one. It could be little, like I am." His uncle Geryon thought it was the funniest thing he'd ever heard, but his uncle Tyget said, "The last dragon died a century ago, lad." That had seemed so monstrously unfair that the boy had cried himself to sleep that night. Yet if the Lord of Cheese could be believed, the Mad King's daughter had hatched 3 living dragons. 2 more than even a Targaryen should require. Tyrion was almost sorry that he had killed his father. He would have enjoyed seeing Lord Tywin's face when he learned that there was a Targaryen queen on her way to Westeros with three dragons, backed by a scheming eunuch and a cheesemonger half the size of Casterly Rock. The dwarf was so stuffed that he had to undo his belt and the topmost laces on his breeches. The boy's clothes, his host had dressed him in, made him feel like 10 pounds of sausage in a 5-pound skin.
"If we eat this way every day, I will be the size of Illyrio before I meet this dragon queen."
Outside the litter, night had fallen. Inside, all was dark. Tyrion listened to Illyrio's snores, the creak of the leather straps, the slow clop-clop of the team's iron-shod hooves on the hard Valyrian road. But his heart was listening for the beat of leathern wings.
When he woke, dawn had come. The horses plodded on, the litter creaking and swaying between them. Tyrion pulled the curtain back an inch to peer outside, but there was little to see but ochre fields. Bare brown elms on the road itself, a broad stone highway that ran straight as a spear to the horizon. He had read about Valyrian roads, but this was the first he had seen. The Freehold's grasp had reached as far as Dragonstone, but never to the mainland of Westeros itself.
Odd that. Dragonstone is no more than a rock. The wealth was farther west. But they had dragons. Surely they knew that it was there.
He had drunk too much last night. His head was pounding, and even the gentle swaying of the litter was enough to make his gorge rise in his throat. Though he said no word of complaint, his distress must have been plain to Illyrio Mopatis. "Come drink with me," the fat man said. "A scale from the dragon that burned you, as they say." He poured for them from a flagon of blackberry wine, so sweet that it drew more flies than honey. Tyrion shooed them off with the back of his hand and drank deep. The taste was so cloying that it was all he could do to keep it down. The second cup went down easier, however. Even so, he had no appetite, and when Illyrio offered him a bowl of blackberries and cream, he waved it off.
"I dreamed about the queen," he said. "I was on my knees before her, swearing my allegiance, but she mistook me for my brother, Jaime, and fed me to her dragons."
"Let us hope that this dream was not prophetic. You are a clever imp, just as Varya said, and Daenerys will have need of clever men about her. Sir Barristan is a valiant knight, and true, but none, I think, has ever called him cunning."
"Knights only know one way to solve a problem. They couch their lances and charge. A dwarf has a different way of looking at the world. What of you, though? You are a clever man yourself."
"You flatter me." Illyrio waggled his hand. "Alas, I am not made for travel, so I will send you to Daenerys in my stead. You did her grace a great service when you slew your father, and it is my hope that you will do her many more. Daenerys is not the fool her brother was. She will make good use of you."
"As kindling," Tyrion thought, smiling pleasantly. They changed up teams only thrice that day, but seemed to halt twice an hour at the least, so Illyrio could climb down from the litter and have himself a piss. "Our Lord of Cheese is the size of an elephant, but he has a bladder like a peanut," the dwarf mused. During one stop, he used the time to have a closer look at the road. Tyrion knew what he would find, not packed earth, nor bricks, nor cobbles, but a ribbon of fused stone raised a half-foot above the ground to allow rainfall and snowmelt to run off its shoulders. Unlike the muddy tracks that passed for roads in the Seven Kingdoms, the Valyrian roads were wide enough for three wagons to pass abreast, and neither time nor traffic marred them. They still endured, unchanging, 4 centuries after Valyria itself had met its doom. He looked for ruts and cracks, but found only a pile of warm dung deposited by one of the horses.
The dung made him think of his Lord Father.
"Are you down in some hell, Father? A nice cold hell where you can look up and see me help restore Mad Area's daughter to the Iron Throne?"
As they resumed their journey, Illyrio produced a bag of roasted chestnuts and began to speak once more of the Dragon Queen.
"Our last news of Queen Daenerys is old and stale, I fear. By now she will have left Meereen, we must assume. She has her host at last. A ragged host of sellswords, Dothraki horse lords, and unsullied infantry, and she will no doubt lead them west to take back her father's throne."
Magister Illyrio twisted open a pot of garlic snails, sniffed at them, and smiled.
"At Valentus you will have fresh tidings of Daenerys, we must hope," he said, as he sucked one from its shell. "Dragons and young girls are both capricious, and it may be that you will need to adjust your plans. Griff will know what to do. Will you have a snail? The garlic is for my own gardens."
"I could ride a snail and make a better pace than this litter of yours." Tyrion waved the dish away. "You place a deal of trust in this man, Griff. Another friend of your childhood?"
"No, a sellsword you would call him, but Westerosi born. Daenerys needs men worthy of her cause."
Illyrio raised a hand.
"I know. Sellswords put gold before honor, you are thinking. Well, this man, Griff, will sell me to my sister. Not so. I trust Griff as I would trust a brother."
"Another mortal error." "Then I shall do likewise."
"The Golden Company marches toward Valentus as we speak, there to await the coming of our queen out of the east."
"And beneath the gold, the bitter steel. I had heard the Golden Company was under contract with one of the free cities."
"Mere," Illyrio smirked. "Contracts can be broken."
"There is more coin in cheese than I knew," said Tyrion. "How did you accomplish that?"
The Magister waggled his fat fingers.
"Some contracts are rich in ink, and some in blood. I say no more."
The dwarf pondered that. The Golden Company was reputedly the finest of the free companies, founded a century ago by Bitter Steel, a bastard son of Aegon the Unworthy. When another of Aegon's great bastards tried to seize the Iron Throne from his true-born half-brother, Bitter Steel joined the revolt. Daemon Blackfyre had perished on the Red Grass Field, however, and his rebellion with him. Those followers of the Black Dragon who survived the battle, yet refused to bend the knee, fled across the narrow sea. Among them, Daemon's younger sons, Bitter Steel, and hundreds of landless lords and knights who soon found themselves forced to sell their swords to eat. Some joined the Ragged Standard, some the Second Sons or Maiden's Men. Bitter Steel saw the strength of House Blackfyre scattering to the four winds, so he formed the Golden Company to bind the exiles together. From that day to this, the men of the Golden Company had lived and died in the disputed lands, fighting for Mere or Lice or Tyrosh, in their pointless little wars, dreaming of the land their fathers had lost. They were exiles, and sons of exiles, dispossessed and unforgiven, yet formidable fighters still.
"I admire your powers of persuasion," Tyrion told Illyrio. "How did you convince the Golden Company to take up the cause of our sweet queen, when they have spent so much of their history fighting against the Targaryens?"
Illyrio brushed away the objection as if it were a fly.
"Black or red, a dragon is still a dragon. When Maelys the Monstrous died upon the Stepstones, it was the end of the male line of House Blackfyre."
The cheesemonger smiled through his forked beard.
"And Daenerys will give the exiles what Bitter Steel and Blackfyre's never could. She will take them home.
Ah, with fire and sword. It was a kind of homecoming that Tyrion wished for as well. 10,000 swords makes for a princely gift, I grant you. Her Grace would be most pleased.
The Magister gave a modest bob of his head, chins jiggling. I would never presume to say what might please Her Grace.
Ah, prudent of you.
Tyrion knew much and more about the gratitude of kings. Why should queens be any different? Soon enough, the Magister was fast asleep, leaving Tyrion to brood alone. He wondered what Barristan Selmy would think of riding into battle with the Golden Company. During the War of the Ninepenny Kings, Selmy had cut a bloody path through their ranks to slay the last of the Blackfyre pretenders. Rebellion makes for queer bedfellows, and none more queer than this fat man and me. The cheesemonger woke when they stopped to change the horses and sent for a fresh hamper. "How far have we come?" the dwarf asked him, as they stuffed themselves with cold capon and a relish made of carrots, raisins, and bits of lime and orange.
"This is Andalus, my friend, the land your Andals came from. They took it from the hairy men who were here before them, cousins to the hairy men of Ib. The heart of Hugor's ancient realm lies north of us, but we are passing through its southern marshes. In Pentos these are called the Flatlands. Further east stand the Velvet Hills, whence we are bound."
Andalus, the faith taught that the Seven themselves had once walked the hills of Andalus in human form.
"The Father reached his hand into the heavens and pulled down 7 stars," Tyrion recited from memory, "and one by one he set them on the brow of Hugor of the Hill to make a glowing crown."
Magister Illyrio gave him a curious look.
"I did not dream my little friend was so devout."
The dwarf shrugged.
"A relic of my boyhood. I knew I would not make a knight, so I decided to be High Septon. That crystal crown adds a foot to a man's height. I studied the holy books and prayed until I had scabs on both my knees, but my quest came to a tragic end. I reached that certain age and fell in love."
"Never a maiden. Yeah, I know the way of that."
Illyrio thrust his right hand up his left sleeve and drew out a silver locket. Inside was a painted likeness of a woman with big blue eyes and pale golden hair streaked by silver.
"Sarah, I found her in a Lycian pillow house and brought her home to warm my bed. But in the end, I wed her. Me, whose first wife, had been a cousin of the Prince of Pentos. The palace gates were closed to me thereafter, but I did not care. The price was small enough for Sarah."
"How did she die?"
Tyrion knew that she was dead. No man spoke so fondly of a woman who had abandoned him. "A Bravassi trading galley called at Pentos on her way back from the Jade Sea. The treasure carried cloves and saffron, jet and jade, scarlet, samite, green silk, and the Grey Death. We slew her oarsmen as they came ashore and burned the ship at anchor, but the rats crept down the oars and paddled to the quay on cold stone feet. The plague took 2,000 before it ran its course." Magister Illyrio closed the locket. "I keep her hands in my bedchamber. Her hands that were so soft." Tyrion thought of Tysha. He glanced out at the fields where once the guards had walked. What sort of guards make rats and plagues and dwarfs? Another passage from the 7-pointed star came back to him. The maid brought him forth a girl,
as supple as a willow with eyes like deep blue pools, and Hugo declared that he would have her for his bride. So